I'll call to order the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee for today, which is February 3rd. Thank you. And do I have a motion to approve the minutes of January 20th?
So moved.
All right. We've got two. Representative Vogel has made a motion to approve the minutes. Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please signify by saying yes.
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 Opposed? Minutes are approved. The first bill up this morning is Representative Portman has a bill, and please come to the testifier's table and introduce yourself. I see you have a testifier, and I'm guessing you want somebody to move your bill. Representative Hillstrom, would you like to move?
Yes,
House
ma'am.
House Bill 383.
Yes, Madam Chair, and where would it we'd like it to go?
This will go direct to the General Register.
Yes, I would move that, Madam Chair.
Okay, very good. Representative Hillstrom moves House File 383 to be referred to the General Register. Representative Portman, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom, for moving the bill. Members, this is a proposed update for the Uniform Trust Code in Minnesota. We currently have a Uniform Trust Code in place, and this is an update that's been worked on for several years. With me today, I have Chris Hunt from the law firm of Fredrickson and Byron, and he will describe the legislation as he understands it far better than I ever could.
Okay. Mr. Hunt, go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chris Hunt, and I'm a member of the firm of Fredrickson and Byron. I'm the chair of a committee that was established 4.5 years ago to study the legislation that we have before us today. And this committee has been active for that time and is a committee composed of 18 attorneys from around the metropolitan area, as well as representatives from outstate, representatives from the bench, representatives from the corporate trust world, and so forth. So we had very broad representation that had input into the creation of what you have before you this morning. We also work closely with the Uniform Law Commission, which is the source of this legislation, and we have their approval with what we're submitting today as well. The reasons that we're doing this update is the last changes to Minnesota trust law occurred in 1989. And in that 25-year period, there's been a lot of changes in the industry of trust law, nationalization of trust service providers, explosion of use of trust as substitutes for wills, and so forth. Our current statute was very well done in 1989, but today leaves many questions unresolved and called for uniform acts. The Uniform Act that was the source of this was promulgated in the year 2000 and has currently been adopted in 27 other states and the District of Columbia, so it's been widely accepted nationally. I think some of the principal highlights to draw your attention to are that the new act adds 20 definitions to trust law. Currently, there are none. We have to rely on probate law and common law for definitions of terms. This will aid practitioners and the courts in dealing with various trust matters. We also have expanded greatly the use of non-judicial settlement agreements. We think this is a good trend nationally. It'll take away from the demands of our courts, which are already overworked in this area, and so encouraging parties to reach their own settlements where that is possible. So we've expanded the topics that they can use non-judicial settlement agreements for. We've also established a dual track for court jurisdiction. Minnesota has based its jurisdiction on in rem proceedings. That means that the trust property is the source of jurisdiction, and the court represents parties that are otherwise unrepresented in the proceeding. The Uniform Trust Code used in personam jurisdiction, which is what's used in the other 49 states. And as a result, we found some parties in Minnesota are going to other states because in personam jurisdiction allows more privacy in trust matters. So we found that unless we offered this option to parties, we may continue to lose people going to states like South Dakota, which has become kind of a trust mecca in Sioux Falls. So we feel that this will give people more choices on how to handle their trust matters in Minnesota and make us more competitive with our neighboring states. We've also expanded the concept of representation, where parties can represent parties in court proceedings, such as an agent representing a principal or a parent representing a minor child. We think this is a great advance as well. We've added the ability to modify or terminate certain kinds of trusts, which gives parties more flexibility in the administration of trusts. We've been very clear about preserving Minnesota's historically strong spendthrift law, and we've not made changes to that. We've clarified that the capacity to make a revocable trust, which is so commonly used now, is the same standard as it is to make a will in Minnesota. We've also changed one of the longstanding rules that allows co-trustees to act by majority action, and so that if a trustee is unable to act because of an illness or some other reason, not all the parties are required to take certain actions, but a party that does not take part in a decision is protected. They're given protections from liability. One new feature we've added to make us again competitive with many other states is the idea of adding what's called a directed trust, where a trustee can take direction from an investment advisor or a distribution advisor or what's called a trust protector. And as long as they rely on the information they're getting from those sources, they are then protected as well. And finally, we're adding a new concept called trust decanting, which has been now adopted in 22 states around the country, which is a way in which trustees can create additional trusts for the benefit of beneficiaries where that's called for. And again, we're following kind of the national trend in this area. So these are a number of the highlights of the legislation. I think we've done a good job of preserving Minnesota's character regarding trust law, but added so many of these new features that the Uniform Trust Code would provide. And I think that this will represent a very substantial advance in trust law and administration of trusts in Minnesota and be a very strong component of our practice in the coming 25 years or more.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Portman, any final words?
Madam Chair, we have a very technical amendment that we'll bring on the House floor. We change 12 numbers from 0.014 to 0.208, and we'll make that change on the House floor.
All right. Sounds good. Any member questions regarding the bill? Seeing none. Oh, Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom.
Portman.
I'm...
We're like twins.
it's too early in the morning right now.
Yes.
It's a long drive down here. One question I have. We have a lot of trusts that are set up already. How is this going to affect those trusts in the future? Are they going to have too many changes, or is it going to affect the trust that we already have with these changes?
That's an excellent question.
Go ahead.
In Article 13 of the bill, it addresses that question. First of all, as to any trust that is currently revocable, there wouldn't be a problem. The new law would, of course, apply to that revocable trust, but the party could make changes to the trust document if that were warranted. The larger question is what happens to trusts that are now irrevocable? And in Article 13, what it says is that if you have a trust that was irrevocable and where the settlor made it clear that future laws would not affect the interpretation of that document, then the changes in our bill will not have an effect there. But if that question is not clarified by the settlor in that document, then the new law would apply, particularly as to the interpretation of the document, the construction of the trust document. As to existing trust litigation, if there's a matter that's currently being litigated in the courts, we've given the courts leeway to decide whether to continue to apply the old law that was applied in the first part of the case and continue to do so, or whether it would want to apply the new law in constructing that trust as well. So we've tried to provide a very flexible way in which to deal with that while still protecting the interests of parties who have irrevocable trusts.
Representative Johnson? Okay, very good. Any further questions from members? All right. Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to refer House File 383 to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You're on your way to the General Register. Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, committee members.
Thank you. I'm looking for Representative Kreisha to see if he's around. And I don't see him. Anybody see him out in the hallway at all? Or if not, we can go ahead with my bill then, I guess.
Thank you.
would like to bring House File 327 before the committee. Do I have a motion to bring House File 327 before the committee?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 327 to be referred to the Committee on Government Finance, State Gov Finance.
Representative Scott, please present your bill.
Thank you. Members, this bill would provide for a constitutional amendment to be voted on by the people of Minnesota in 2016. As you can read, the ballot question would say, shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended so that people are secure in their electronic communications and data from unreasonable searches and seizures as they are now likewise secure in their persons, homes, papers, and effects? As you can also read in the bill, as in current law, no warrant would be issued without probable cause. And the warrant would have to describe any electronic communications or data proposed to be assessed. This bill is a 21st century protection of our Fourth Amendment rights that currently protect us from unreasonable search and seizure. I believe this amendment is in the spirit of our founders' intentions in the Bill of Rights of protecting citizens against government intrusion of their persons, houses, papers, and effects. This committee has spent and will continue to spend a great deal of time catching our laws up to modern technology. The Data Practices Commission met 8 times over the interim. Most of what we covered was related to new technology that is allowing the government to collect more and more data on each of us. At some point during testimony we heard, I started to question whether we as individuals were protected at all from this massive gathering of data. I believe this bill and amendment is needed to at least protect the very private communication and data we all have on our electronic devices. Think of conversations you've had online or texting. How many of us have income and other sensitive information on our computers, banking information, household budget information detailing where we have shopped, what charities we give to, and what doctors or clinics we go to? This amendment would not change situations where a warrantless search could be conducted. These exemptions are on the document in your packets entitled What Does the Fourth Amendment Mean? From the U.S. Court's website. This includes if an officer is given consent to search, if the search is incident to a lawful arrest, if there is probable cause to search and exigent circumstances, and if the items are in plain view. This amendment passed in the state of Missouri last fall by nearly a 75% margin. As lawmakers, we took an oath to protect the Constitution of this state and the nation. We all want to do what's in the best interest of the people that we represent. I believe this amendment is consistent with the intent of Article 1, Section 10 in the Constitution of Minnesota and the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and it is indeed in the best interest of the people of Minnesota. With that, I'd like to move to testimony, and we can take questions when the testimony is over with, if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please, testifiers, come forward. Good morning. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Benjamin Feist. I'm the legislative director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota. ACLU is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to defending Minnesotans' civil liberties under the United States and Minnesota constitutions. We have about 8,500 members statewide and many, many across the nation. We believe the Minnesota Constitution is a foundational document that should not be tinkered with lightly. Accordingly, we often oppose proposed amendments that contract rather than expand individual rights. Today, we support House File 327 because it expands individual rights and does so in a way that's consistent with our traditional understanding of the prohibition against unreasonable searches and seizures. This proposal simply clarifies a constitutional provision by adding electronic communications and data to the text. The proposal will eliminate ambiguity with regard to how our Constitution applies to modern electronic records and data. It will also eliminate excessive litigation in criminal cases going forward, which will in turn lead to less need for judicial resources. Technology has advanced, but our laws have not kept up with the digital age. As members of this committee know, the last few sessions we've seen new technologies and new surveillance techniques popping up all the time. This is a great example of a proactive approach to taking care of these things in a way that is consistent with our constitutional values. This proposal will make clear that the Fourth Amendment protects our electronic communications and data regardless of these particular technologies and surveillance techniques that we know will pop up again. Today, the legislature should act because the courts have been slow to address these issues. Until the recent Supreme Court case of Riley v. California, courts disagreed about whether you actually needed a warrant to search a cell phone incident to arrest. Court made clear in that case that the Fourth Amendment does apply to searches incident to arrest, but the case left ambiguity in other areas. For example, the court did not address the larger question of government searches of cell phones and surveillance of our electronic data and communications outside of the context of an arrest. Another example is the current issue with the NSA and metadata. We really don't know at this point whether the Fourth Amendment would apply given the court's lack of any guidance so far. A state constitutional provision guarantees that Minnesotans will have this protection even if the Supreme Court overturns Riley in the future or other decisions undercut the warrant requirement. Just last session, the legislature passed a bill to require a tracking warrant for a cell phone tracking, but the legislature could undo that at some point. This makes it clear that we have a constitutional value to protect. Where we go online, whom we email, and what we say reveals a great deal about us, and the government shouldn't have access to that information without a warrant. Our right to privacy for our persons, houses, papers, and effects remains as true today as it did over 200 years ago, whether those papers and effects are stored in our desk drawers or in the cloud. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have clarification that I'm looking for. So in some areas of Minnesota law, we allow people to access certain kinds of records through an administrative subpoena versus a full search warrant. Would this do anything to distinguish or to stop those administrative subpoenas to get access to records versus the required search warrant?
Mr. Feist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I'm actually not sure on those particulars. This, I believe, is meant to be broad, to cover a lot of types of electronic data and communications, and I think it might take some time to explore exactly what this will cover, but it's meant to be broad, to cover a lot of things.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a number of questions. So first, you talked about the sheet that Chair Scott handed out, talked about the Fourth Amendment. We're talking about the Minnesota Constitution. So, Mr. Feist, how has the Minnesota provision, Article 1, Section 10, been interpreted versus Article 4 of the, pardon me, versus the Article 4 of the Bill of Rights in the federal Constitution? Can you just talk about the distinction there?
Mr. Feist. Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto. To my knowledge, we've had pretty consistent interpretation between the Minnesota Constitution and the federal Constitution. The issue that we're looking at, though, is that we have the ability to be more protective in Minnesota and to legislate that into our Constitution. I think that it's a great direction to go. Other states are moving in that direction, and while it's slow in coming, I believe that eventually the Supreme Court will get around to getting this right and making clear that those protections would apply nationally.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Feist, so it sounds like what you're saying is that you feel like the courts will get to the place of saying the Fourth Amendment does encompass electronic records.
Mr. Feist.
Mr. Chair, Representative, and so yes, I believe that at some point that is likely to happen. We might be a while away from that right now, and these new technologies are continuing to increase and be used with additional frequency. So we think the time to act in Minnesota is now, and also to make clear with an amendment like this what our values are, because as we know, the Supreme Court itself could overturn a decision, as I said, like the Riley decision or some of these other recent decisions that have come out to protect privacy. We simply don't know. So, you know, I can speculate and say that these issues are likely to rise to the level of the Supreme Court and get a decision, but I really can't tell you when that will be. So I think it's very appropriate for the legislature to act.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I actually wasn't done with my question.
Sorry, Mr. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Feist, because it sounds like the cases that you've cited, the courts have, in fact, interpreted the Fourth Amendment to already encompass electronic records. And I guess my thinking is, when I look at the language of both the Fourth Amendment and also of this provision in our Constitution, I would think that my papers and effects do, in fact, include my electronic communications and data, and it sounds like the courts have agreed. They've been slow, but of course, you know, it's technology changes, it's difficult. So it sounds like the courts have, in fact, already interpreted it this way. And I guess I'm trying to understand the need. You talked during your testimony about eliminating ambiguity and clarifying, but I guess it seems like the courts are, in fact, getting there. So I guess I'm trying to understand the need for this beyond just sort of a general statement.
Mr. Feist?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, yes. I believe that where we're at right now is, again, from the ACLU's position, that yes, the court should find that electronic communications and data do fall within the Fourth Amendment or our state analogy. But right now there's simply just too much uncertainty. You know, the cases that have been decided are very limited in their scope. In the Riley case, it was searches incident to arrest, a cell phone. We don't know what else that would apply to at this point. Another example that we had recently is the case of GPS tracking of a vehicle, where the court has found that you would need a warrant to track a vehicle around town for an extended amount of time. But at the same time, we're having arguments within this committee about license plate readers and whether that type of location tracking should have some type of warrant. So I think it's far from clear, unfortunately. And this sort of statement will let law enforcement and the public know what our values are and what the obligations are.
Representative Scott, did you have a comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just go back to the fact that last year, as Mr. Feist said, we did have a bill that said in order to track our cell phones, you had to have a warrant. So we were already having to clarify some of these issues, and I think this just solidifies it. And I think it's a necessary thing until the courts do catch up. Well, if they do indeed catch up.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll just say, I guess it's probably obvious from my questions. I have concerns about this. Mr. Feist talked about providing less need for judicial resources, but I guess my thought is I'm not sure that that's the case because, of course, this language has to be interpreted as well and figuring out the exact outlines. The fact is that apparently from Mr. Feist's testimony, the courts have said that there is a warrant that's necessary for cell phone tracking. And the only cases that have been cited so far are cases in which, in fact, the courts have ruled that there's a warrant that is necessary. And I get concerned about amending our Constitution to clarify things that the courts are already doing. I think we need to be really careful about that sort of thing. I guess I don't know that this would in fact lessen the need for judicial resources. And if all this is doing is eliminating, is clarifying something that, as I say, the court is going that direction anyway, I guess I have great concerns about that. So, but I appreciate the testimony, Madam Chair, for you bringing the bill forward. Thank you.
Mr. Feist, comment? Representative Scott? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for your testimony. You know, one of the things that occurred to me while I was sitting here listening to testimony is the, you know, the Affordable Care Act and electronic transfer of all our health information that seems to be going on. Would this amendment in any way protect that type of information from being accessed outside normal channels?
Mr. Feist?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I honestly have not focused on that particular area of data. I maybe counsel could clarify with us.
Mr. Green?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen. So the language in the proposed amendment doesn't specify anything related to the Affordable Care Act or health records, although it does sort of broadly protect against unreasonable searches and seizures in, as you can see, it says persons, houses, papers, and effects. I don't know. I'd have to look into it to see if there'd be any specific application to Affordable Care
Act. Mr. Chair. And I would
Representative
just say,
Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just say, too, with the Affordable Care Act, people are giving their information. That's not to say that we shouldn't address the transfer of that information and so forth, but I don't know that this amendment necessarily covers that.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a follow-up comment. I would strongly urge you to look into that because, obviously, a person's health information is one of the most private things that they value. And we're moving that information onto electronic transfer, and to the degree that we can specify in this amendment that that is also protected and provide some protections for that. And again, a lot of the concern, whether rightly or wrongly, is that that health information might be accessed by unelected bureaucrats in order to make decisions about what type of care, if you get care, and when you get care. Now, we can argue whether that's a valid concern or not, but that's a concern of a lot of people who question the ability to transfer their health records between different agencies. So I guess I'd strongly urge you to look into that and see if we could be more specific in some way as far as the amendment's concerned. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen. The amendments are considered as restrictions on government activity. And so to the extent that a private corporation is holding this data, our hands are tied to a certain extent unless we want government to invade the province of private industry and how they handle health records. Now, you know, with respect to the HMO data problem that we're running into, the question about that being that it's a governmental function, $8 billion a year of four major HMOs running this health information in the state of Minnesota. Now, when you're talking about the Affordable Care Act and private insurance companies, I think you're right. There's concern about health data, but as far as Fourth Amendment law and unreasonable searches and seizures, to the extent I stayed awake during criminal procedure in law school, I know that 95% of it applies to criminal law. And the safeguard of it is that that evidence, if it is illegally seized under the terms of either this amendment or the federal constitution, that it's unusable in a court case against you in criminal law. So I think the civil side of it, what you're talking about, on health records is a lot more squishy, and it's going to be difficult to get your hands on just by virtue of the fact that private companies are holding it.
Mr. Chair? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that response, Representative Lesh. Yeah, I would simply respond that it's no longer a private corporation when the government micromanages and provides subsidy on the operation. We basically are moving healthcare to a quasi government function. And it, you know, once government gets involved, it seems like their micromanagement of the information gets more and more all the time. And to the degree we can provide some protections within our Constitution from that type of micromanagement, I think it would behoove us to at least research it. But I do appreciate your response, and thank you for the opportunity to respond.
Representative Lesh?
For my question, or for...
Yeah, okay, thank you. So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Feist, my first question relates to the Missouri situation, where this passed, I think Chair Scott said 77% of the vote. Was there a court case in Missouri where they were having problems and they wanted to set this out in the Missouri Constitution, or was this kind of popular paranoia based on the prevailing trends on expanding data usage? Were there any tangible court results that were yielded in Missouri after this amendment was passed?
Mr. Feist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, I'm not aware of particular court cases in Missouri. From my understanding of that situation, it was passed with an overwhelming majority, both at the legislative level and when it was put forward to the people. It's just sort of a straightforward privacy and data issue. So I could definitely do some more looking into that. I have colleagues in the Missouri affiliate who were involved in that and probably have some more information. But again, to my knowledge, I don't have any specifics.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. And Mr. Feist, this dovetails a little bit off of Representative Pinto's question, which I take issue with Representative Pinto's question a little bit, suggesting that court cases have been trending in this direction. You touched a little bit on court decisions regarding license plate reader tracking. And I'm concerned because we've got no indication of the U.S. Supreme Court, the direction they're going on that yet, with the exception of a case that's already over 3 years old now, U.S. v. Jones from January 2012, where it involved specific tracking of a vehicle with a GPS device underneath. Now, that involved the tracking of an individual car going beyond the boundaries of the specified warrant signed by the federal judge. The court did not speak to it, but they did suggest that if government was going to track vehicles en masse using electronic means, the majority stated that this may in fact be unconstitutional, but we haven't approached that yet. The concurrence went even further, which I think was Justice Ginsburg, and said, no, there's no question about this being unconstitutional. So I have concerns that the rapid expansion of electronic surveillance is growing to the point where we're already 3 years out and we have no indication from the U.S. Supreme Court, which, at least with respect to Minnesota, this would clarify things more. However, to Representative Pinto's point, the line on 1.19 of electronic communications and data, would data under this amendment, would it mean that that means your location? Is your location in any given part of the day your data?
Mr. Feist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, I believe an argument could be made to that end. However, there isn't any certainty on how that would be interpreted. You know, the ACLU believes that that could be a reasonable reading, and would be a good way to go. But as you were mentioning, you know, from the Supreme Court level in particular, we have very narrow rulings right now on what this means for location tracking. And to go back a little bit to address Representative Pinto's point as well, I should mention that the federal courts have been split on issues of cell phone tracking that we dealt with last session. There are federal courts that have said you do not need a warrant to track the location of someone's cell phone. So that issue, while it hasn't risen all the way to the Supreme Court at this point, I think is a good example of the fact that there is a split mind out there. And you know, what we're really looking for is some general clarity on what our values are. So I don't know if that answers your question very well.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could ask Representative Scott. Representative Scott, under the the language of your amendment, is your location throughout the day your data that should be subject to a search, constitutional search, under the terms of this amendment?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesch. I think I agree with Mr. Feist that that's fairly unclear. To me, that is part of my data. I would also add that in Missouri, they're figuring out, in, you know, having passed this amendment this year, they're figuring out the enacting language. And so certainly, you know, that would need to be addressed. And I appreciate you bringing that up, and I would be glad to try to figure that out and let folks know, because it's an important question.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I just note that the amendment, maybe we could have more conversation about this in subsequent committees this goes to as well, but the courts have made clear that using electronic surveillance to surveil a single person is not unconstitutional, you know, provided it's, you know, within the parameters of the law. But your where you are in a given point in public is not, you know, information that should be subject to a search. But if you're talking about in mass, of course, and the metadata to which Mr. Feist had alluded earlier, it's entirely a different question. And the amendment itself does not speak to that, the massive collection or the metadata surveillance or analysis. So I think that's something that could be brought up in future committees. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Feist, it sounds like you're saying that the courts have been interpreting this term papers and effects in the Minnesota Constitution to include electronic communications and data currently. And as you know, courts interpret statutory and constitutional text to have every term have a meaning. And so I guess I'm thinking that by adding electronic communications and data, by pulling that out and adding that specifically, that courts would interpret this provision to give more protection for electronic communications and data than for others of a citizen's papers and effects, because right now papers and effects includes electronic communications and data, at least under some court interpretations. And is my question clear to you? And if so, can you describe that? Because I'm concerned about providing greater protection for that particular class of my property, of somebody's property, as compared to others.
Mr. Feist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, I'm not sure that I agree with your interpretation that electronic data has been, over the last few years, included in papers and effects, for one thing. I think what we're really looking for here is just clarity, that those would be treated exactly the same. We wouldn't want to put additional weight on the electronic means. I think we just want to say, look, if the framers were dealing with this issue today, they would have included our electronic lives as part of the items protected under the Fourth Amendment. It's just because we've had this rapid influx of technology and data issues to deal with that we're now trying to make absolutely clear that we don't want to be litigating this out for years and years and years, which types of personal papers and effects we're really talking about. We're just trying to find a line of clarity, I think.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think I'll just comment that I guess I'm concerned that by spelling out the separate category, that courts would in fact give it greater protection, give electronic communication data greater protection than other papers and effects. But I understand we may have a disagreement there. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions or comments for Mr. Feist? Representative Hillstrom.
Actually, it's a question for Representative Scott. I apologize.
Oh, sir. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. Representative Scott, do you plan to have this bill also go to public safety? I just want to make sure that we actually talk about the differences between needing an administrative subpoena versus a search warrant, which happens a lot in criminal law, and the difference between, for example, is a search of the data that's already been collected about you, for example, through LPR, is that then become protected data under this language? I just want to make sure that everybody understands the implications as this moves through the process. This is the first time I've heard the bill. I really hadn't heard anything about it prior to this hearing today, and I just want to make sure that we take into account all of those other issues.
Well, I would certainly have a conversation with Representative Cornish.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments for Mr. Feist? Or Mr. Feist, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Scott, any other testifiers?
Yes, I believe there's some on your list there. And
please identify
Meister's here.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. I'm here in a role as a privacy advocate, a very strong privacy advocate who's been dealing with these concepts for a number of years before this body and very familiar with the law. Let's go back to the 1948 movie, Treasure of Sierra Madre, where Goldhat is speaking with Dobbs. Dobbs is the person played by Humphrey Bogart. And I'm going to parody a little bit of it. Dobbs is confronted by Goldhat. This is not the actual words. There's just one word substituted. If you're the police, then where's your warrant? Of course, the issue was badges, but I'm paraphrasing a little bit. Gold Hat comes back, warrants? We ain't got no stinking, we ain't got no warrants. I don't have to show you any stinking warrants. In 2015, this is one of the kinds of things and concepts that's happening. When our personal papers and effects and we as a person is being constantly violated our privacy rights because what has happened, all our papers and a great number of our effects are held by third parties. They're not in our desk drawers. They're not in our home. They're not where there is a search warrant needed. There are two court decisions by the Supreme Court, one in 1976. It was called Miller versus U.S., and then another court case in 1979 that was called Maryland versus Smith. And the bottom line that the Supremes basically said, hey, you have no expectation of privacy of records and data. The term is records, but it still means the same as data. It's held by third parties. And so what has happened over the last 40 years, we have developed aspects of what we call administrative subpoenas. And with, if you take a look at a great document that the House Research has done since 1994, they have updated it. The last one was 2006. You will see some 75 state agencies, including city councils, and on the locals, I don't know how many, have subpoena power using the administrative subpoenas to get documents and records from third parties where they're no longer in our homes. So our calendars, our pictures, our business documents, our most personal kinds of information is held by third parties. A lot of people think, oh, it's all in this little computer and they need a search warrant to get this. That's not the case. They're all held by third parties. So the crux of what the amendment does is basically says you're going to need a search warrant in a great array of many situations. And that's what you're giving the people of Minnesota to decide. This is not no where Missouri last year decided to do it or Wyoming is now doing it. This has been a nonpartisan issue for the last three or four decades where a number of states have inserted the word privacy, more specific in their state constitutions, from California to where now currently Wyoming is doing it. And now you are entertaining that. So one of the things that I think is very important to recognize is how the issue of technology. Now, you all are dealing the issue. We've had CCTV surveillance, video surveillance, body cameras are on the horizon, things like that. But behind that is facial recognition. Facial recognition is getting so much to the point to where you can put it, let's say, on a body camera or a camera, and you can say, Rich Neumeister is walking down Wabasha Street, where I live, in downtown here, by government doing that. Is that a search? Some people will contend that is a search under the Fourth Amendment. And if you're going to do that, you're going to need a search warrant or protection for particularly that kind of specific. And that's what you're allowing the courts to decide those kinds of things. The other issue that was brought up here is about medical records. And I'll only give two examples about that to illustrate that. 6 years ago, you as the legislative body decided to collect millions of prescription records on every Minnesotan basically that gets a prescription. Decided to give that database, and now if you extended it, it used to be destroyed, some of this data right away, but it's no longer, it's being kept a little bit longer now, on every Minnesotan. One of the things that got involved in the argument was that law enforcement and government, other government entities, wanted easy access to that. They wanted to be able to share it. There was talk about, oh, we just want an administrative subpoena to do it. But myself and a few other people said, no, that deserves the protection. It was sort of like a lockbox within government. If government is going to keep this kind of data, and it's very specifically in that law, you need a search warrant. Again, the technology allowed for keeping millions and millions of records of the drugs you take, we take, your constituents' stake accessible. Now, the same thing here is with our most sensitive data, and there'll be someone that will talk about that on, I think, who may testify about medical records. And it's all over the board. It could be gotten by administrative subpoena, maybe through a civil subpoena that some state agency may have or government agency. I know within criminal things that sometimes they need search warrants. It varies. I do know that at one time the Hospital Association recommended, this was several years ago, that you need a warrant. Now, the thing is one of the important things that what you are offering the people of Minnesota to do is whether or not the Minnesota citizens and residents that live in this state shall have the highest protection that can be granted for the privacy and from the intrusion of government and collecting information about us is basically the probable cause search warrant. It's that simple, it's that clear, and that's the decision that you have to make. My point of view is that talk about court cases and those kinds of things has taken decades. Last year, and I was instrumental in being one of the folks that put this bill, because I found out that technology was being used a little bit where they're tracking location information using Stingray, Kingfish, whatever you want to call it, and other kinds of technology.
Excuse me, Mr. Neumeister, in the interest of time and other testifiers, 1 minute remaining.
The last time that piece of legislation, the 626A, dealing with wiretaps, was ever amended was 1989. So the issue is it also depends on whether or not there's interest to take every kind of situation and then come back to the legislature and have the big fight or whatever, or you say to the courts, with the citizens' blessing, hey, courts, we believe that there is an expectation of privacy. We encourage you to interpret it, and, of course, we'll see what happens. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is not no new thing. A number of states have done this. A lot of things are happening, and I think as this bill goes through the process, I'm sure there will be other kinds of discussion. I'm here to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions or comments? Mr. Neumeister, thank you.
Thank you.
Is Ms. Twyla Braze available? Good morning. Please identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president and co-founder of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and we have done a lot in the area of medical privacy, per se. We know that Minnesota has been more protective of privacy, particularly in health data, where our health records law is more protective than HIPAA. And this is another opportunity for Minnesota to be more protective than or ahead of the game in the privacy protection area of law. So House File 327 offers citizens a measure of protection against the government search and seizure of our most personal data and communications stored on devices and in third-party clouds that could include conversations, photos, private thoughts, medical details, health and lifestyle data, and more. The issue of government surveillance has become huge across the country, and the concern is growing, not receding. A person's electronic communications and data could potentially include not only confidential information on the individual who holds the device or has the contract with the third-party entity storing the electronic data, but it could also include electronic data on individuals with whom the person has been communicating, including friends, family, members, associates, physicians, banks, stores, and more. Given the expansion of personal data on electronic devices, the expansion of mobile health, and the expansion of surveillance systems, whether they be visual, health, location, just to name a few, this bill allows the people of Minnesota to determine whether they want it clarified that electronic data held in their own hands or in the hands of others with whom they have contracts deserves the same protection under law provided by the Minnesota State Constitution for the more concrete items of persons, houses, papers, and effects. We support House File 327. Thank you.
Any questions or comments for Ms. Braze? If none, thank you, Ms. Braze. Is Mr. Matt Erling here? Please state your name and to whom you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Matt Erling. I'm here on my own behalf today as a citizen who has been following issues of government power and civil liberties for 2 decades, writing about this in the press, and also been involved in policy change in regarding federal search and seizure law, particularly regarding the Patriot Act. So I come here today to speak in support of this amendment for the following reasons, and I think as background I would say that entering into amending the Constitution should be done very, very cautiously and judiciously. And I think that 3 criteria need to be satisfied before one goes down that path, and I think this proposed amendment meets those criteria. The first is that, as a threshold matter, a Constitution should really secure rights to the people. And that's been part of American constitutional tradition since Patrick Henry and the Anti-Federalists appended the Bill of Rights to the original federal Constitution. And state constitutions since that time have incorporated these kinds of individual rights protections into their body. And so we see here that this proposed amendment seeks to clarify and to secure additional rights to the citizens of Minnesota. So I think it meets that first really key threshold of securing rights to the people. Secondly, and importantly, I think a constitutional amendment should not be entered into simply to perform the job that a statute could otherwise perform. I think that constitutional change should be looked at carefully and deliberately and should embody broad principles. And I think here this proposed amendment meets this criteria as well. A lot of folks here have talked about the background to this, the third-party idea that digital data is increasingly held by third parties. And this amendment really seeks to correct the direction of federal case law, going back to Smith versus Maryland and the idea that information given over to third parties deserves less protection than traditional Fourth Amendment protections. And as more and more digital data has been vested with third parties, you've seen the federal government really develop search and seizure protocols that have said, well, we're going to look at third-party data as less than protected by a reasonable interest of privacy that would be attached to the Fourth Amendment. And so this really is attempting to remedy that situation. And it's addressing, as the language says, both communication and data. And I think that second part is really the key part here, this idea of metadata, even more so than communications, because communications can be looked at and have been looked at differently by different federal circuits. It's taken a long time for email, for instance, to work its way through federal circuit courts to arrive at the same level of protection as traditional letters, for instance. But this issue of metadata, location data, the locations of mobile payment use devices, the locations of where you use your credit card, and as more and more home devices get connected to the internet, there's all manner of information that's about what we're doing in our homes that's going to be vested with third parties. And the question of whether that stuff is protected by a reasonable expectation of privacy, I think, needs clarity. And I think this proposed amendment would offer that kind of clarity. We've also seen the practices of federal law enforcement agencies informing how state and local law enforcement agencies have been working. For instance, the FBI has taken the position that location data of cell phones is not protected by a reasonable expectation of privacy. And some local and state agencies took that very same view until the legislature last year added a warrant requirement for the use of Stingray devices to track that location information. Now, this is just simply one statutory change that the legislature made to address this. But as I've said, there are many, many other kinds of digital data out there, and there's many other circumstances where you could make a statutory change, but I think it makes more sense to look at this more globally and at a higher level, and that's why a constitutional amendment is relevant in this circumstance. Thirdly and finally, I believe that you should avoid amending a constitution if there's another way to solve the problem that you're looking to address. And as I've already spoken to, the interaction of the development of federal case law and the actions of federal law enforcement agencies, state and local law enforcement agencies, has created a really complex situation that needs high-level clarity. And I think a constitutional amendment gives you that kind of clarity to address those sorts of things. So I'd be happy to take any questions, but I think this amendment, this proposed amendment, meets the three criteria that would make it qualify for passage by the people of the state of Minnesota. So thank you very much.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Ehling, is it your understanding that the Supreme Court has stated the federal constitution provides individuals no reasonable expectation of privacy for discrete instances like single instances where someone can see you on a street? Is that your understanding?
Under the plain view doctrine, yes, that would be the case.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Ehling, would this amendment then make electronic data unviewable, or would it state that people have a reasonable expectation of privacy in those instances for electronic data, despite what the courts have stated the federal constitution does not provide?
I think the distinction is, if you look at, say, cell phone location data or other device location data, that's the kind of data that I think would be protected by this, not simply viewing someone in public, but the vesting of your location data with a digital third-party entity, and that entity holds that information. That's what's addressed here.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Ehling, if I stated, if I wrote on Facebook, this is where I am right now, I'm over at Super America getting a Coca-Cola, that's electronic. Would that be protected under this amendment, in your understanding?
If you've exposed that information to the public by posting it on Facebook where it can be seen, I don't believe that reaches it. If you are holding it in some other digital device by a third party and not exposing it to the public, then it's protected.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I want to ask Mr. Ehling also about, you touched a little bit on the difference between metadata and mass groupings of data versus those individual discrete instances. And I do not see language in the amendment that highlights that difference. So how would you state that the amendment does address the differences between what you put yourself out there on something, whether you're secure in that data or not, versus the mass collection of aggregate instances of these? Did I need to rephrase my question, or you get that? Let me rephrase it. How does this proposal impact the collection of metadata?
It's going to impact the collection of metadata to the extent that metadata attaches to things that people reasonably expect are private. So your location, say that you have a home monitoring system for temperature and you're using a cell phone app to measure the temperature of your house while you're gone, something law enforcement could have an interest in if they want to see if you're growing pot in your basement, for instance. But you don't expect that because you're giving over your temperature information to a digital third party that the police will be able to automatically access that at a low threshold. So things that you would reasonably expect to be private about your person, your whereabouts, your activities, that are vested with a third party in a digital format would be protected.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, and I realize the problem for this is the courts have not addressed that yet. As I cited in just the one case, the courts have not stated whether or not the mass collection of that we have a reasonable expectation of privacy or not. And I don't think the amendment expressly addresses that yet either. I know I'm struggling with this honest policy matter. I know other folks are as well, but I just kind of wanted to get your take on that, because we're talking about discrete instances versus aggregate instances and the differences between those. If someone knows where you are at a particular moment, it's not that intrusive. If someone has 100 of those throughout a week, while each individual instance is not an intrusion, the collection of it is huge. They paint a picture of your entire life. So that was my question. I think you answered it as best you could.
I see where you're going. And if Mr. Chairman, if I can just simply add one more thing, Mr. Chairman. I think that's a separate issue, but also raises a constitutional question that's very weighty. And it gets to the question of whether this aggregate collection is, in fact, a reasonable search. Right now, that's being grappled with by federal courts who are reviewing the NSA metadata, phone metadata collection cases. The idea that, again, and it hinges on third-party information. Do you have, they believe, the federal government, that is, they don't believe you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in who you're calling, the numbers to which you're calling to and from. So they take that individual instance and then multiply it on a mass scale, and they say that we have, as the NSA, the ability to collect all of this data because there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in it, collected on a mass basis. And I think that gets to another question then, is that collection reasonable? And I think that's a discrete and separate collection, but also an equally weighty constitutional question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just by way of closing comment, I'd state that I understand people's concerns about this, and whether it's the NSA, the CIA, or OGA, other government agency. Most of those agencies are careful, extremely careful, never to put themselves in the position of actually having their authority challenged in court. So that's the only time when the laws we make here would even matter, is to whether or not their practices are put under some constitutional review. And if an agency like that reaches that point, they've already lost. So there will be some, I'm convinced, collection of data on us in an unauthorized manner, as certain information has come to light illegally, and it will continue to go on to the extent that it is extrajudicial and beyond the reaches of legal authority. But to the extent that there are agencies that we can keep under legal authority, I generally think that this amendment is going in the right direction, which is why I signed on, and I applaud Representative Scott for bringing in Representative Peterson. This is Senator Peterson's in the Senate, isn't that right? Representative Scott, I think it's going in the right direction, but I think it's worthy of even more robust discussion, so thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've heard a couple times that this is protective of data held by third parties, but I guess I'm struggling to figure out how, since it says the right of the people to be secure in their electronic communications and data, and use the example of the, you know, where I use my credit card. But if MasterCard collects that data, they've got that data, I didn't collect it, I might not even think about it. I guess I'm wondering, if we're so concerned about how the courts are interpreting the current language in the Constitution, are we so confident they're going to interpret this and that the way to be so protective of third-party data as you're suggesting?
I would take the view that this is a way to place in under there the people's protection, that iterated list of homes, persons, places, effects, and digital data makes it analogous to those other things that have always been protected by, that attaches to the individual and is protected by a reasonable expectation of privacy, even in the instance where a third party holds that very sensitive data now. And so that's where I would try to drive that interpretation.
And Mr. Chair, it seems like the answer to any question regarding interpreting this, right, is we're just going to have to see what the courts do. And I guess to my view, that's the problem with putting something like this in the Constitution, is that any question we may ask you about how this will actually work is just going to depend on how the courts interpret it. We can all make our best guesses, but I guess that's the concern I have with then spelling out a particular category like this. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Scott. So, in theory, then, if this is a constitutionally protected versus case law, if we have that right to be secure with the data, then would this prevent private businesses from sharing as well? Because now all of a sudden this is a constitutional, or should it?
The Fourth Amendment protection is purely adheres to the government, so it bars the government's access of private data.
Okay, and my question is then, why not increase the protections in the private sector and the civil liability? This is sensitive to everybody, and we've had some incursions, so why aren't we looking at that as well too?
I think that could be looked at as a separate issue if people have business to business or consumer to business privacy concerns, absolutely. But I think the Fourth Amendment issues are discrete from those.
Okay, Mr. Chair. So all the emergency exceptions under the Fourth Amendment actually come from different case law. I mean, each one, they're not all the same. What can you give me some answers of how this might affect those emergency exceptions and the case law that's surrounding them?
Exigent circumstances in the home entry situation, for instance, is a recognized exception to the Fourth Amendment. Case law will develop over time if the courts see fit, and I think that that applies to papers, effects, persons, homes, and so the addition of an enumeration of these specific things doesn't preclude exigent circumstances case law from being developed.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott or whoever, then, if that's the direction we're going, you say that case law will be developed, then why aren't we, if you're not worried about case law being developed around that, then why not let case law be developed around this?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. The founders and the framers of the Constitution didn't delineate everything in the writings. They left, realizing that there are three branches, they left some things open for interpretation, for reasons that they knew that they couldn't include every possible scenario. And this is a case where we will rely on the courts going forward, but we're giving them guidance here that they're to take special care and look in addition to the things that are already protected by the Fourth Amendment. This is included in those things. So I see what you're saying, but this is an issue where the courts do have to. We can't lay out every possible scenario, and so the courts are going to have to do some work in this area. But we can't cover for every single scenario that could possibly come down.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you feel like you're bolstering your argument, and I feel like you bolstered mine, that we can't cover for every scenario. And that is why a lot of this gets developed that way. And, you know, some days we have folks that say, this is the Constitution. I interpret it just by law. That's what I live by 100%, and there's no other wiggle room. We can't touch it. We can't do anything with it. And then on the other side, then we'll have another argument where we're saying that the Constitution is imperfect and it, you know, they couldn't have planned for every scenario. And I agree. I think there is some openness in there that says, well, we don't know what the future is going to bring. Times are going to change. And I want to agree. I think this is a good conversation because we don't know what's going to happen 40, 50, 60 years from now. And as I said the other night to Mr. Gamberling, you know, I don't want the cops or anybody coming into my house and taking my things when I'm retired. But I also feel that way in the private sector, too, that once I give my information to private businesses, and I think most of society doesn't understand what happens with their private information because we've allowed private business to be secretive and sell it, trade it when they sign an initial document that's 25 pages long in font that even I couldn't read with eyeglasses if I needed them. So, but I do think that we have to be very careful because, like it or not, when we do make changes, it has effects on the case law that was put into place before. Right now, if I call when I'm at work and if I call T-Mobile or AT&T and Verizon and a family member calls to me and gives me just a minutia of enough credible information that, say, you have a child that's suicidal and he or she has a cell phone, I get to pick up the phone and I get to call them and say, I need you to ping this phone, here's what's going on, here's the case number, and I will fax you the emergency request. Same goes with a kidnapping victim or anything like that. There are various exceptions even amongst the companies. And this scares me without further clarification to make sure that those companies know the day that this would go into effect, no, don't stop what you're doing because that's not what our intent is. But if this goes on, I can tell you right now that every law enforcement agency in Minnesota is going to have difficulty with cell phone companies in that emergency order because they're going to be fearful of what their civil liability is. And for me to draft a warrant, even if it's telephonic, and to get a judge to answer the phone is going to be at least an hour process where it's signed, then faxed, because they'll want their legal department to have it in hand. But right now, I can have Representative Zerwas can be the operator at Verizon, and I can call him, give him the information, and he can push a button, and we can have it in 10 minutes or better. So these are the things that I get concerned about, and if you can address them, I think that's what we really need to talk about, because it sounds like when you're going through this, when I hear the words, I don't believe that'll happen, that's not what we're trying to do, and I know that this is part of a conversation, and we'll have work to do on it, but please take those things into consideration and really think about what's being done here, because I think everybody in this room can agree that we dive into the Constitution, especially around these particular issues, the first of many important amendments that were there when this country was founded. We're taking steps that we really need to be cautious about.
Mr. Ealing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, two reactions. One is that I think the idea that judicial oversight, which would necessarily attach to probable cause determinations, is somehow too slow or cumbersome or burdensome. That was exactly, it's not to make it burdensome, but to place an additional check was exactly and precisely the intent of the founders, to place a check between the administrative process of law enforcement before they can go out and execute a particular search. And I think inserting the judicial function there is wholly appropriate in instances where it attaches to individual private data. And in regards to the interpretation of case law, the very fact that this amendment is coming into is being proposed addresses deficiencies in federal case law. And it shows that the people of Minnesota say, hey, look, we are concerned about where federal case law is going in regard to search and seizure in the digital realm. We are going to add these additional protections that address this third-party digital data issue. So that's the reason why it's being done. It's because there's been a drift in case law at the federal level, and this would add some clarity at the Minnesota level, saying we don't agree, we'd like to see a different direction.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just, like I said, I'm not comfortable that your language addresses the clarity around the exceptions and what that might do, simply because of the disconnect sometimes between the companies and what happens here. And that could have very dangerous side effects for families in Minnesota. So I just want to make that clear.
And to our last question or comment from Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, I wanted to speak to this because I think Representative Schoen's concerns are correct on this. But I would note, as has been stated before, that the Fourth Amendment and all case law governing Fourth Amendment, I want to stress again, is a restriction on government. So while there are equal concerns and private corporations are starting to develop systems and bureaucracies equivalent to government, Verizon can still not put you in jail. And they can't hold you for 36 or 48 hours before they charge you, and they can't draw probable cause statements against you and get a criminal conviction and keep you in prison. So with respect to the private actions, which in many people's daily lives are becoming equally equivalent because of potential financial liability or issues related to their children, like Representative Schoen brought up, there still are outs for that. For example, liquidated damages provisions or estoppel in law that I think gives us an out for that. And for me, the most important thing is still the potential action by government. But in some way along the line, this is going to have to be brought up vis-a-vis Representative Schoen's concerns, because the amount of data held by private companies is growing more and more. And I think Representative Grunhagen brought that up earlier, too, with respect to health records. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Ealing, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone from the audience who wishes to testify on House File 327? Please come forward and state your name. And we ask that you limit your comments to 2 minutes, please.
Then I don't have anything to say.
Thank you. All right. Representative Scott renews her motion for House File 327 to be re-referred to the Committee of State Government Finance. Is there any additional discussion on this bill?
Mr. Chair, just one comment. The last testifier talked about there being a number of federal cases that have ruled the other way, but the only cases that I heard cited were cases where courts did in fact require warrants. So if this does continue, I guess I'd like to know what kind of cases there are that that have gone the other way, because I didn't hear any specific cases cited. I just want to note that. Thank you.
So noted. Thank you. All right. If no additional discussion, we will vote. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
The motion carries. And House File 327 shall be is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee of State Government Finance.
Representative Kreisha, I believe, is up next with House File 191.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning, Mr. Kreisha.
Good morning.
Representative Grunhagen, would you, first of all, would you like to put the bill before the committee?
Yeah, I move to put the bill.
House File 191.
House File 191 before the committee.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And I believe, Representative Kreisha, you may have an amendment to get the bill in the state that you would like it to be.
Madam Chair, I'll move the A3 amendment.
Okay. Representative Zerwas moves the A3 amendment. Representative Kreisha or Representative Zerwas, would you like to explain what the amendment does? Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Zerwas. So the amendment adds a little bit of clarifying language in the reports that need to be prepared by DHS. And what we're asking is when those reports are prepared and sent to their respective legislative leaders and committees, that there be no identifying information so that you could not figure out who was called out in these reports, and that they're just very broad and top line so that we can look at the data in the welfare system and looking for the reports that way.
Okay, thank you. Any discussion by members or questions regarding the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the, is it A1? A3 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Go ahead and present your bill, Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for having me with this important bill. This is a bill that has come out of the Governor's Child Protection Task Force bill. This is the second stop. We heard the bill on HHS reform, and in this bill, we're looking at some of the data that's involved with this. So I'll walk you through a couple of things, and then if House Research could fill in any of the gaps that I might miss. So the first thing that we're doing in this bill is we're asking to repeal what we did in the last session, which was barring screened out and screened in historical reports as well as collateral information. What we have found out or what has been acknowledged is that historical data is very, very important when considering maltreatment reports. So this bill will repeal that, and it will allow law enforcement as well as county social workers to look at the historical screened in, screened out reports to make a determination on the risk of the child. The next piece that we're doing is a screened out report, and we're striking may not be used for any other purpose, and we're adding that it's in accordance with subdivision 11C and paragraph E. What this just simply does is cleans up the language a little bit and calls out the definition of statute. And then the last section handles any of the screening guidelines as well as and allowing those screening guidelines to be created by DHS, and that counties would implement those as soon as they receive reports on those. And the biggest reason for this is we found out in all 87 counties the biggest challenge we have in the child protection system is variability. Protocols that are in statute but are not necessarily being followed consistently among all 87 counties, and with the mobility of families right now, we're trying to make sure that those policies and practices are followed in a consistent manner so that we can stay ahead of these families and we can make sure that we're getting to the protection of the kids first. And then the last area of the bill handles reports from DHS that we would like the commissioner to develop a plan and to perform quality assurance reviews of county agency screening practices, and that that information be shared so that we can review that. And if I've missed anything and House Research can help me out, that would be wonderful. I like the thumbs up. Thank you.
Yeah, you've got the heads nodding. So, Representative Kreisha, are there testifiers in the audience who would like to testify in this bill? Please come forward and state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Melinda Hugdahl with Legal Services. We work with at-risk families, including directly with at-risk youth. I want to thank Representative Kreisha and Representative Mullery and the other members of the task force. They've been doing a tremendous amount of work on this issue. It's a really important issue and a really important bill, as Representative Kreisha has noted. There are a lot of really good things in this bill, including the focus on child safety, making sure that all sexual abuse allegations go to investigations, increasing the oversight and the consistency that Representative Kreisha has talked about from the department, that focus on consistency. And a good thing of the bill is removing the lens of what information goes to law enforcement based on whether it's screened in or screened out. There are cases where it makes sense, even if it doesn't fit within the construct of what's a child protection case, that may show, for example, evidence of a crime. And so having it that lens of it be removed, we think can get some information to law enforcement that they should be seeing. So we want the good information to go to law enforcement so they can investigate crimes, especially if they impact a child, regardless of whether they meet that framework. The task force recommended that all calls that come in will go to law enforcement. In areas of the state, that's going to be a new practice. Some areas of the state, that's happening. Other areas, it's not. Within that universe of the calls that come in, there's going to be a variety of types of calls. Some are reporting a crime. Some may suggest evidence of a crime. And that universe, unfortunately, may also involve some calls that are either mistakes or not made in good faith. The issue we just want to note is an issue that the bill hasn't addressed yet and the task force hasn't discussed at this point, and that's simply how, in that universe of cases, how that is handled when it goes to law enforcement. And the universe I'm talking about is the case where there's no evidence of a crime, that it may be a false report, that there's really, the person hasn't done anything, as it turns out, as your social services has looked at the case. When the call suggests a crime's involved, law enforcement should receive those calls and be able to fully investigate them. If law enforcement's the actual reporter, which happens often, the data from the department's shown, this is also not an issue, as the information originated from the agency. But the portion of the universe that involves a person who, it turns out, hasn't done anything will be a new portion of records in that universe that some law enforcement agencies don't get now. And how and by whom they're accessed or retained is left open in the bill. So I don't want to suggest that calls to come into child protection aren't serious, they shouldn't be taken seriously, or that we shouldn't err on the side of records over protecting kids. We shouldn't. But for the end of the spectrum where there is no risk to a child, where it's a person where it's been determined that nothing to the call, we will be creating a record in a place, and we haven't had a conversation of kind of where that record lies. So that's simply the issue that we wanted to note in this committee. It's the committee of jurisdiction for the issue. I know the task force is still meeting and still is talking about a variety of issues, and so as that work goes forward and these issues continue to be discussed, we just wanted to raise it for the committee and note it for the record. So I want to thank Representative Kreisha again. He's been great, and we've been talking with him and with law enforcement as well.
Thank you, Ms. Hugdahl. Representative Lesch has a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kreisha, this concerns me because we're seeing this more and more. I think about the whole LPR debate, for example, is surrounded around all these folks that have non-hit data on them, who shouldn't be subject to the scrutiny of law enforcement because they haven't done anything wrong, but we're still retaining records on them for one reason or another. How was that taken under consideration during the discussions of the working group
And how is it that they came about to the conclusion where we should be retaining data on people who haven't done anything wrong?
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Lesch, for the question. So in talking to law enforcement and talking to investigators, this is already in statute. It's supposed to be it's actually supposed to be handled right now, and many counties are doing that. What we found out is many counties are not. Some are not. So sending the information to law enforcement is already supposed to be happening, whether it's screened in, screened out. We're just calling that clarification. So that's where the discussion came in the task force. When we talk about the issue of these reports, I don't believe statute is going to change people's behavior and whether how they're going to make reports. And if a neighbor, I mean, we can look at the anecdotals of if there's a neighbor that just out of anger makes this false call, I suppose those are going to happen. But by and large, of the 19,000 reports that came through in 2013, 77% of those were biological parents, and there were connections to the abuse in the biological families. And many of those came from police officers as well as social workers and schools. So I understand that concern, and the question that I have is, what are we really trying to protect? Who are we really trying to look after? We know that in these instances with these kids, the adverse childhood effects to what they're going through can affect them so badly that I think we have to have an extra layer of sensitivity and making sure that we're taking all those very seriously. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's how I look at that.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kreisha. I don't think so. I mean, like, and not anything you said, I think, answered the question, but maybe we misunderstood each other. I'm not disagreeing with you that these kids need to be looked after. We need to make sure we're okay. Just like in the case of LPR, nobody's arguing about the cases where we have hit data on individuals who've done something wrong. I'm talking about the folks for whom there is no reason that we should be keeping data. And maybe you are answering my question and saying, well, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs, in which case we got to retain data on innocent individuals. If that's what you're saying, we'll just have to agree to disagree, but maybe you can clarify that.
Representative Kreisha, has the task force taken that up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I said, we've had this discussion, and I'll go back to this is already in statute. It's supposed to be it's supposed to be practiced. We're just calling it forward to help. So what we did not take it per se in the conversation we're having. We didn't take it this far. The task force looked at this and recommended and said, listen, there's variability among the 87 counties. Some are not following this practice, even though they're supposed to be. So we're recommending that become consistent across the counties.
And if I might, I would just say, moving forward, I know the task force is still mm-hmm. continuing to meet, yep. and one of the things you would want to address with them probably is, and definitely would want to address, is what to do with the data on innocent people that where the cases have been found to be non-founded. Representative Hilstrom, it looks like you have a question to this effect.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to make it clear that sometimes when folks report something to Child Protection, it maybe doesn't meet the standard of a child in need of social services, but it really might need to be passed on to law enforcement. For example, when it's two children who maybe are perpetrating on each other, or one child is doing on another child, there may be neighbors. That isn't really something where social services then steps in to protect from the parent, so it's not a CHIPS case, but it certainly is something that needs to be passed on to law enforcement. So it isn't that something wasn't found to be a problem. And so we just have to make sure that we're really careful about just because something that's reported to Child Protection doesn't meet the criteria for protecting a child from the parent doesn't necessarily mean that it's data about an innocent person. And so that's where we get into real, sometimes difficult situations with the language. We need to be very, very clear that we allow all the information that needs to get to law enforcement to get there, so that they can investigate any of the crimes that are happening. And when you find in one incident that the abuse was not founded, there is then a later call where they find it. And so if you, for example, would not allow that data to be retained at all or would have 0 days, you might not be able to then find out the next time someone calls that there in fact really is abuse going on. Sometimes it's that pattern of contact from multiple sources that cause you to know that there really is something serious going on.
And Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Crescia.
And thank you, Representative Hillstrom. That's very helpful. And I'll add this. Where we're at in this process is not a determination of guilt or innocence. Where we're at in this process is a determination of risk to the child. Are they in a safe situation? Are they not? And the reason I bring that up because the screened out reports, and I certainly understand there may be somebody who something was a false positive, something happened that really that the allegations maybe are not founded. But what we do know is if we don't keep track of these, they will tend to add up. And so while it may not be neglect this time, it may not be physical abuse this time, after four or five of these, we have to look at the total compensation of all those reports and say, wait a second, something really is going on here, and that's why we're asking the other set of eyes, that's why we're asking to look at the data, because it may not be that first time I walk in as an investigator and I look at the house and I say, you know what, it's not what it appears to be in the allegation. But after making five of those visits, shouldn't we have the ability to go and say, you know what, maybe we're missing something here. And again, we're not looking at guilt or innocence. We're looking at, is that child in the safest situation possible? And more importantly, if not, that's why we have family investigation. Maybe we mentor the, this is an intervention time. Maybe we mentor the parents. Maybe we improve the situation before we go to investigation. And remember, the law is very clear on when we go to investigation, and that's substantial child maltreatment. And so there's a lot of determination here, but if I'm helping, guilt and innocence is not one of those at this stage.
Thank you, Representative Crescia. We have less than 15 minutes here. Representative Johnson has a question, then we need to get on to
thank you, Madam Chair.
Our next testifier.
Madam Chair, Representative Crescia, I've talked to quite a few of my investigators that deal with this issue. In my community, they're doing the cross-reporting already. One of the big things that they claim that they do not get, you know, which would be important to them, in these, even in these false accusations or not enough data to do an investigation and, or multiple complaints, law enforcement community never gets the follow-up reports. They don't find out, don't know the outcome. So they're concerned that they're not getting all the information that they actually need if it should go to a criminal investigation, because they don't get all the information. And that's one of the concerns they brought up.
Any comments?
No, Madam Chair. I appreciate that, and I will follow up on to make sure I understand that process and that I'm not missing anything. So thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Ms. Hogdahl, for being here. And our next testifier is Rich Gurman. I believe I have that pronounced right. Representative Hilesh.
Yes. Testifiers coming down. I just wanted to note that, you know, I think this conversation is good, because what I'm hearing is, you know, this is about the best interest of the child, and more information is always good. Well, I suspect that if I sat outside Representative Grunhagen's driveway and watched his driving behavior day after day, I'm willing to bet I'm going to catch him make a few errors.
Never.
I don't think so. I bet you have not made a complete stop at a stop sign sometime in the last month. So point being that the suggestion that number of calls or number of reports is a critical component, equalizing everyone, suggesting collection of evidence, which is not used for criminal investigation now, but can be, absolutely can be. I think that is a fallacy. It can certainly be true on occasion, but the equivocation of just number of calls, we need to hang on to that because that's the indicator. I think we need to be careful about that, because it's not just this area of law where we're starting to rely on that. It's other areas, too. The LPR debate, I'm sure we're going to talk about it, in body cams and facial recognition as well, too. So I think it's important to be mindful of that when we revert back to, well, hang on a second, we're only worried about what's happening to the kids here. Absolutely. But we can't be ham-fisted about it, because there are other rights here involved. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Gehrman or German? I don't know how to say it. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
It's Rich Gehrman. I'm the executive director of Safe Passage for Children of Minnesota, which is an advocacy organization, a citizens group that advocates for children in the child protection system. And I'm also a member of the governor's task force on child protection. I think just a couple of points to share with the committee. First of all, there has been a great deal of discussion in the task force and also in the committee that I'm on. It's called a work group about many of these issues. And I think the primary focus has been the safety and well-being of the child. So, for example, when you talk about keeping track of repeat reports, and we have been thinking of this more as internally to the Department of Human Services and the counties, I take you back to one of the reasons this task force got set up was the Eric Dean case, in which that child was reported 15 times to child protection, screened out 13 times, offered voluntary services twice, which were rejected, and then the child was murdered by his stepmother. Subsequent stories, there have been 56 children who were killed by members of their family or their household between 2005 and when this series of investigative reporting articles began. Many of them had been reported 5, 10, 15, sometimes 25 or more times to child protection without action. So we got to put this in perspective. There is sometimes something to be learned from a pattern of calls over time, whether it's abuse or neglect. And by the way, there have been 6 more children killed in this state since the task force began its work, in addition to those 56. And at least 4 of them seem to have been known to the Child Protection Agency in the county, although the county doesn't always share that information, but from the history in the papers. So I think we have to balance the safety and well-being of children and the historically what has happened with this program in the last 15 years in Minnesota has been that the emphasis has been on family assessment, which is essentially about trying to do family preservation or reunify families, sometimes at almost any cost to the child. So I just want to, let's put this in perspective in terms of the balance between the children and I think and the adults. And I think what Representative Creech's bill does is call out that recommendation from the task force to make the safety and well-being of the child the primary concern of the system. I do think there's a lot of things to be sorted out yet in terms of the details of this. May go beyond the life of the task force, which gives its final recommendations at the end of March. Collateral context, for example, we need more specifics about exactly how that should happen and when. But I will say that historically, collateral contacts has been a part of good social work, and it can be managed well in a way that doesn't kind of get into digging into things that don't need to be discussed. I guess one final point is that a great deal of the emphasis has been on really rigorous fact-finding that will hold up at later stages in the process. And so now the process for most cases is to get the family together around the kitchen table or, you know, in the living room and just to talk about what's happened, whereas standard practice historically has been to go through a more rigorous process of meeting with the children separately and, if possible, prior to meeting with the adults and other steps that are recommended by county attorneys and law enforcement to make sure you get the best picture you can about what happened. And I would point out that that not only is the best way to protect the children, but if someone is falsely accused, that allows you to have facts that are objectively put together and that can't be as easily challenged down the road as having been done, you know, in a careless way, so that if something does come to the courts, that person who's falsely accused has the best chance possible of having the facts come to light. So those are some of the considerations in the task force, and of course, both from the point of view of our advocacy organization and task force, we support Representative Creech's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Gehrman. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for your comment. Just a quick comment, because I know we're running out of time, is I find myself in agreement with Representative Lesher's comments. And my, you know, I'm a lay person. Most of my exposure to this has been as a school board member. But in several situations I've noticed that I've been involved with, parents, once an allegation is made, parents are assumed guilty until proven innocent. In other words, it's not the basis of normal law. You're guilty based on the allegation until you can prove otherwise. And, you know, at some point, parents become fearful of even disciplining their children. And we want to stop these terrible problems. But, and I think, you know, when you do that, it's also a form of child abuse. Children without discipline, okay, can cause a lot of havoc and problems later on in society. So I guess I would just urge you that when there is an innocence, and yes, Representative Lesch, if you sat at the end of my driveway, you would see me break a number of laws driving. you'd have to make a citizen's arrest, I guess. No, but anyway, I just caution there's a balance there, because from what I've seen in my experience is that, you know, you're guilty till proven innocent based on an allegation. And we want to stop these, but on the other hand, we don't want to open the door to just any type of allegation. The last thing I'd say is, you know, we've restricted the right of teachers and administrators in a public school to discipline, especially in the area of corporal punishment, and some states have now re-legalized that. And the result is teachers are afraid in many cases to get involved in very difficult situations, and now we have police walking the halls of our schools, okay? So, again, my caution is to not to bring some balance to that, and also keeping records on people where they're proven to be innocent is a concern of mine as this process goes along.
Thank you. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I just want to provide maybe a little bit of context or a little bit of perspective in what Representative Crescia's task force or the task force that he serves on was set out to do, and really the public outcry that generated the creation of that task force. When you have a family that has, you know, over a dozen and sometimes over 20 engagements with protective services, to where really, whether time after time and red flag after red flag, the system just doesn't act. And then later we're told, well, we didn't consider the previous calls, and we didn't consider that serious. The reality is. And you can equate it to waiting at the end of a driveway, but we're not talking about rolling through a stop sign. We're not talking about no signal. We're talking about children, in some instances, stuck in a home, and they can't speak up for themselves, and they cannot call out for help for themselves, and they cannot protect themselves. And so then it's incumbent upon government to protect those children. And if that means that we need to provide follow-up, and that if you get one red flag, that doesn't really seem too egregious, and two red flags, that maybe don't seem so egregious. When you hit 15, there is a problem, Madam Chair. And we need to keep all of that in mind. And we need to allow our investigators to keep all of that on the table so you can look at the totality of what's going on in that household. It's not running a stop sign.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. And in the interest of time, we're going to move to our next testifier, Mr. Neumeister. And if Mr. Plaitzer could be on deck and ready to go, that'd be great.
Madam Chair, members of the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee, I'm here as a privacy and open government advocate. It's been 31 years that I've been involved in child abuse issues about who shares data, how it happens. Two important things, and this is what happens. An outrageous incident, a tragic incident is done, and how it's found out is by an enterprising reporter who digs and got a lot of information from the Star Tribune. The first question is, why did that happen in the first place? So when you are doing these laws, you have to take an above picture look, because this is a system-wide issue. What information is available that's transparent that we, the public, or an enterprising reporter, can take a look to make sure that this does not happen again? And I think that's important that you take a look at that as this bill goes through the process. Where are the points for transparency where the public can start to ask the questions? Who watches the watchers that this does not happen again, 5 times or 10 times or whatever? On the other side of the coin, again, over the years, and currently now, I'm working with a family who's had a number of allegations against them, but they don't know how to get the information so they can assert their own rights to take a look. So then, again, a system-wide thing where more information may be gathered, collected,
even though they may have not, but it's been the law, it does have ramifications for the a very centered right that about family and children and how they're raised. So those are my two points. What is the public accountability transparency on this system where we can get reports so this does not happen again? And that the rights of the parents are important, too, to get the access if there's false accusations. Or why are they asking, why are teachers and other people asking me all these questions based on the number of reports that are shared in the system? So, Madam Chair, I think it's a good bill. I think there are some questions. But anything is not simple, particularly over the last few decades. It's secret, open, share, not share, destroy, not destroy. So it's a tough one, and I hope that Mr. Kresha and others will engage on some of the issues that were highlighted in this committee as the bill progresses.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Mr. Platzer, please come to the podium and state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ross Platzer, I'm here as an individual citizen today. I know the time's running short, so I'll be brief. I did give a handout. I think the task force has done well so far, but I think that it's a great opportunity to take a much bolder step. If the underlying philosophy is what I think it should be, see something, hear something, say something, then I think it makes only sense at this point to increase the mandatory reporting to at least one of the groups that has temporary custody, and that's coaches and other sports people. They're not necessarily all educators now, at least even in the public schools, private schools, and after school. Those people make relationships with people. They see things. They hear things. They should be mandatory reporters. Secondly, it seems to me in a just and decent society, any citizen who knows something should report. And I know that sounds a little outrageous, but if you look at page 3, we already have a situation in Minnesota called the Good Samaritan Law, which was passed in 1994. If you are walking your dog in your neighborhood at 9 o'clock at night and you see a bicyclist sprawl down on the sidewalk in the gutter unconscious, you are required to notify the police. The statute says if you're at the scene of an emergency and you know another person is exposed to or has suffered grave physical harm, you shall get help for them. That's a petty misdemeanor. Now, you don't even have to cause the accident. You come upon it because you're taking your dog for a walk. If you see someone or know that they really are being abused, you need to report it. We have to have a state that does that. You can take the mandatory misdemeanor penalty off those people, but we really need to keep those people involved. Right now, it just says you may report if you know or have reason to know or suspect. If you may know or you suspect, that's fine. But if you know, you need to report it. Thirdly, my last point, I've searched the statutes, I've searched the regs. I don't see anything in there, and maybe I'm wrong, that you can do medical and psychological other testing without parental consent. It's often to the parents' advantage not to consent. So I think we need to have a mandatory, if the welfare agency or possibly even a prosecutor or the police think there's reasonable cause, there should be an override of parental consent to photographs, diagnostic testing, ultrasound, medical and psychological exams. Parents cannot stand in the way of that. I'm a little surprised, and I hope the committee becomes bolder. Their modifications are technical. They're good, but let's actually get something done. Let's get people reporting. Let's not let parents override the system. And let's encourage, as we have with coaches in the concussion area, people to know and see things, to say things. Now, I know that sounds like everyone's going to become a Gladys Kravitz or the woman who turned in Anne Frank, but we've got to understand that either people are decent or they're not decent. I choose to believe they are. I don't know how many false reports your committee has found, but there is a statute that if you do a malicious false report, it is a misdemeanor, sometimes a gross misdemeanor. But I would urge, if the committee is not going to be bolder, the task force, then this committee, please look at making it a more aggressive system. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And members, we are out of time, and I appreciate Representative Kresha bringing this bill. I know that it's got a couple of other stops at least. And so Representative Grunhagen would renew his motion to re-refer House File 191 to the Committee on Public Safety and Crime Prevention. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Representative Carisha, thank you for your time. The motion prevails, and you're on your way to public safety and crime prevention.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for the great discussion. Thank you.
Meeting is adjourned.